Well, for the sake of the children, we do have Sunday school sessions, which are taking place just outside the meeting hall here. We have tried to cover all the age groups. As well, for those of you who will be staying late today, we do have a movie planned for this evening for the children to watch. It has something to do with bugs. The next talk that we have today is by Brother Tom Roggerello. And for the benefit of the recorders, today is May the 1st, 1999, and he's chosen for his topic, The Wrestlings of Jacob. The Wrestlings of Jacob. Brother Tom.
Thank you, Brother John. Good afternoon, brethren. It's so nice to be here with my family, to be with you. I bring you the love and greetings of your brethren in Chicago, and especially Brother Ben and Irene Danieski send their love. You know, he had recent knee surgery, and he would love to come here. This is his annual convention, but this is one time he couldn't make it. And I also send the love of Brother Aaron Keymichael. I spoke to him, and he wanted his love sent to you all. Well, I'm sure you all remember the famous Old Testament Bible story of Jacob wrestling with the angel. It's found in Genesis, the 32nd chapter. But when you study the life of Jacob, you come to learn that angels were not the only things that he wrestled with. We're going to start our discussion 20 years earlier, before the time of that he wrestled the angel. And we're going to focus in on a life full of wrestling for Jacob. Did you know if you ever watch the Olympics or sports like broadcasts like that, you know that wrestling is a sport where one man tries to outmaneuver the other and tries to pin him to the ground, and it's not always the strongest man who wins, but the most clever, the one who knows the most maneuvers. Well, you know, there are many ways that people wrestle in life, and most of those don't include physical contact between them. They're maneuvering for a better job or to elevate oneself over someone else. Well, human maneuvering was something that Jacob was an expert at. 20 years before Jacob wrestled the angel, he had a wrestling match with his father, Isaac. You remember it was the incident where he tricked Isaac into giving him the blessing of the firstborn instead of to Esau, his older brother. The account begins in Genesis, the 27th chapter. We're not going to take time to read it, but I will relate the story to you. And then we'll talk about where Jacob's life went after that experience. Remember when Isaac was old, he called his eldest son Esau, and he wanted to give him the blessing of the firstborn. And he told him to go out and hunt and prepare a meal of venison and bring it in unto him, and after the meal, he would give him the blessing of the firstborn. But Isaac's wife, Rebekah, overheard that discussion, and she went to her younger son, Jacob, and she instructed him to go to their flock, which would have been a much quicker proposition, and pick out two young goats and bring them to her, and she would prepare them just the way she knew Isaac liked it. And then Jacob would go into Isaac and pretend to be Esau and take the blessing of the firstborn. And the deception would work because Isaac was virtually blind. He couldn't see who was before him. And Rebekah was really clever. She knew that Esau was a very hairy man and Jacob wasn't, and that Isaac would probably suspect something, and so she had Jacob put goat skins on his hands and on the back of his neck, so in case Isaac would check, he would be deceived into thinking that this was Esau. In fact, she went one step further, and she took some of Esau's clothing and put it on Jacob so that he would even smell like Esau, who was an outdoor huntsman, and Jacob wasn't. Jacob was an indoor man. Well, the trick worked. There was some initial suspicion by Isaac, but he finally gave Jacob the blessing instead of giving it to Esau. Well, think of that story for a minute and think of how Esau would have felt when he came in from the field after hunting the venison and preparing this meal. In Genesis 27:34, we're told that he cried with a great and exceeding bitter cry. And in talking about Jacob, Esau says, "Is not he rightly named Jacob? For he hath supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and behold, now he has taken away my blessing." And in verse 41, we're told that Esau hated Jacob and said in his heart, "The days of mourning of my father are at hand. Then I will slay my brother Jacob." Well, these words were told to Rebekah, and she immediately warned Jacob and told him to flee to Haran, which was the home of her brother Laban, and then when the danger was past, she would send for Jacob to return home. Well, brethren, when you consider that story, what do you think about what Jacob and Rebekah did? They were very clever. They thought of all the details that would have tricked Isaac. In fact, Jacob even outright lied when Isaac said, "Are you Esau?" And Jacob said, "Yes, I am." Well, there may have been at least a couple of reasons why they might have felt justified for what they did. First, at the birth of Esau and Jacob, the Lord had said to Rebekah that someday the elder would serve the younger. That's in Genesis 25:23. And one might reason, well, Rebekah had to do something in order for that promise to come true. One of the inherited rights of the firstborn was that he would assume headship of the family, so that firstborn would have the younger serve him. So just as they used to serve the father in the household, once the father died, the firstborn took that place. Well, in light of what the Lord had told Rebekah at their birth, that the elder would serve the younger, how could she let this go without intervening? And second, you remember, was that Esau had sold his birthright to Jacob for a pot of stew. In this deception, Jacob may simply have been claiming what was his birthright. Now, one question we don't know, did Isaac know about that purchase of the birthright between Esau and Jacob, and did he choose to ignore it? If he did, there may be some responsibility on Isaac's part, but we don't know that thing. We do know that Isaac intended to pass the blessing of the firstborn to Esau and not to Jacob. Well, brethren, when you look at those reasons, and maybe you can come up with more of what might have justified their actions, but I don't think there was justification for what they did. I think they were clearly wrong for lying to Isaac. Though the Mosaic Law hadn't been given yet, the principles against lying is a universal principle, and I'm sure Rebekah and Jacob were well aware of it, even though they felt, well, in this case, the ends justified the means. If you read the story as it goes on from there, you have to have a sense of pity for Esau, because he comes to Isaac and he pleads for his birthright, for his blessing. And it's very easy to understand how he could resent everything that Jacob did. And I also wonder how this must have affected his relationship with his mother. I would imagine that Rebekah tried to keep this whole scheme quiet so Esau wouldn't know that she was really behind it, because it certainly would have alienated Esau from her. Well, this entire series of events would change their lives. It would have consequences for years to come. In fact, their lives would never be the same because of this experience. As a result of Esau's rage, Jacob did flee to Haran. Remember Haran? It's where Abraham stopped for a time until his father's death, and then he entered the Promised Land. It's a place in Babylon. It's the place that God wanted Abraham to leave. As it turned out, Jacob lived there for at least 20 years after this. Because of Esau's reaction, we're told that Rebekah was now afraid of losing her son Jacob to the wrath of Esau. Brethren, in this story, it appears that Rebekah never even saw Jacob again for the rest of her life. And you know that that's not what she had in mind when she made this whole story. And so in the loss of Jacob, she experienced the consequences of her own sins. For the rest of her life, she must have wondered how the Lord was going to fulfill his words of the elder serving the younger, seeing that the elder was stronger than the younger, and that the younger was afraid of him, and now even living in another country. In looking at the story, it's clear that Rebekah's views of how the Lord could overrule an experience were very narrow and short-sighted. Isaac was deceived one more time in the story. At the end of chapter 27, Rebekah told him that the women in Canaan are not desirable, that we should send Jacob to Haran to find a wife amongst her family. Now, that statement of hers was probably perfectly true, that the women in Haran maybe were more desirable to find a wife. But they were given to deceive Isaac and to give Isaac a reason for sending Jacob back, sending him away. And Isaac, as you know, accepted the proposition, and he sent Jacob to Haran. Again, we have to ask, was the scheme that Rebekah came up with and that Isaac carried out, worth it? It's an interesting story in studying to see how the Lord deals with the sins of his covenant people. In spite of these actions, as we read in the rest of Jacob's life, we find out that the Lord blessed him over and over again. Jacob was greatly loved of the Lord. And after this incident, we see that blessing coming from God. But does the Lord work that way? Does he bless those who lie and deceive, even if they're his people? Well, you know the answer. The Lord's blessings on Jacob did not mean that God condoned his wrongdoing. As I said, every negative action has consequences, and they did on Jacob and his mother. Jacob came to pay a high price for what he did, as we'll see as the story progresses. But while he endured the consequences of the sins that he committed, the Lord continued to lead him in different directions and bless him along other lines. One important point to recognize, and I think we've all seen this over the years, is the utter honesty of the Bible. We saw a lesson earlier of the life of David. He had his sins exposed for all future generations to study. How would you like your sins exposed that way? Well, Jacob was the same way. These people in the Bible were real, and they made mistakes, just like you and me, and the Bible doesn't hide them. But we also see that when the heart is basically loyal to the Lord, and they try to learn from their mistakes, that the Lord forgives, and he deals with their sins, and he turns them around to learn to love righteousness. And as a result of their learning heart condition, he can still use them as his covenant people. That concept of how the Lord deals with the sins of his covenant people, whom he's obliged to bless, but still has to deal with the wrong, is something important for us to learn too. How we can deal with the shortcomings of others and still deal with them in a constructive, loving way. We have to learn it, brethren, because that's the education we will need in teaching the world in the kingdom. We see in stories like this that God can do great things through imperfect people if those people are willing to accept his instruction. And there's a simple lesson here that just kind of jumps out at us, that the Lord's people should be the greatest lovers of righteousness on the earth. We should have the deepest appreciation for righteousness and truth, and understanding that the way you do something is just as important as what you do. In knowing God's promise for Jacob that the elder would serve the younger, I think Rebecca should have just let the Lord work that out and not take things into her own hands. And if she saw things working in a way that appeared to contradict the Lord's words, then she should have taken it to the Lord in prayer and sought his counsel and direction and let him fulfill the promise that he made. No action on Rebecca's part would probably have been the right action in the eyes of the Lord. And you know, sometimes, brethren, waiting on the Lord is the greatest act of faith that we can do. Rebecca didn't need to be clever for the Lord's will to be done. If the Lord made a promise and he said it, it would happen, even if the circumstances of life made that seem unlikely to her. And how about Jacob? What lesson is there in his actions? Now, if I were to ask my children that question after reading the story to them, they would say, oh, the lesson is simple. Don't listen to your parents. Look at what his mother made him do. And you know, in this case, they would be right. If our parents, or anyone else for that matter, should steer us in a sinful direction, we should understand the importance of putting principle first and realize that we are responsible for our own actions. Cannot blame others for making us do something wrong, even if they're influencing us in that direction. It's interesting in the story, I hadn't realized it before, but Jacob was not a young man here. He was not an innocent boy. He was 77 years old when all this happened. And one thing I did appreciate about Jacob is that he didn't blame his mother for making him do this sin. So again, there is a good lesson of taking responsibility for oneself. The next 20 years of Jacob's life were lived away from his family. But during those 20 years, we see the Lord working with him and blessing him and bringing him to a different condition of heart. Very shortly after leaving for Haran, remember God gave Jacob the dream of the ladder to heaven. where he saw angels ascending and descending from God. And in that dream, God reiterated the Abrahamic promise to Jacob. In Genesis 28:15, he then adds a promise that he would, a promise that would have made a great deal of difference to a man who was afraid and who was fleeing for his life. He says there, this is God talking to Jacob, I am with thee, and will keep thee in all places whither thou goest, and will bring thee again into this land, for I will not leave thee until I have done that which I have spoken to thee of. How reassuring the Lord was to Jacob here. You know, he had just committed some great sins, and yet the Lord gives us this wonderful vision of a connection to heaven, and then makes the Abrahamic promise again to him, and then says, I'll even bring you into your own land. At this point, this was a great comfort to Jacob. And it showed Jacob that though he had sinned, he still had access to God, as shown by the vision of the ladder. In the 29th chapter, we see Jacob continuing his journey. And he finally gets to Haran, or the general vicinity. And the first family member he meets is his cousin, Rachel, turned out to be his future wife. And I'm almost astounded at his first actions. First thing he does is water her flocks. And then in Genesis 29:11, we read that Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted up his voice and wept. Well, let me ask you brothers, how many of you kissed your wives the first time you ever met her? Or better yet, how many of you cried the first time you ever met your future wife? Well, the kiss probably isn't as forward as we might think. Clark's commentary says that it was a simple and pure method by which the primitive inhabitants of the earth testified their friendship to each other. We see it happen again when his uncle Laban comes. Laban kisses Jacob. So it's more of a family kiss than a romantic kiss. But then, the next question is, why did Jacob cry when he met Rachel? The reason isn't stated, but maybe to Jacob, what his mother had said to Isaac, maybe it was really on his heart. You know, Jacob was getting old, and he was still unmarried. In Jacob's mind, his journey may have been not only a flight from Esau, but maybe he really was going to find a wife, as his mother said. Jacob knew the very romantic story of how Abraham had sent Eliezer to find a wife for Isaac. You know, brethren, if you piece the stories together, this may have been the exact same watering hole where Eliezer's 10 camels were watered by Rebekah, and where his parents' love story really began. How many times do you think Jacob heard that story in his life? And now here at the same spot, he meets this beautiful young woman, to him a picture of true loveliness. The things that happened recently with his family, I'm sure, were very distressing and stressful, hard to deal with for Jacob. So when he saw Rachel, maybe he felt, oh, now there is hope for happiness in my life. He must have mulled over the Lord's promises to him that a great nation would come out of him. But he was unmarried, and he was an old man. In Rachel, maybe he saw the potential of God's promises coming true. You know, most men, at least that I've ever met, don't cry when they meet a woman, even a beautiful woman. So Jacob's tears must have been a release of anxiety and a recognition that the Lord still was caring for him. Well, Jacob now went to work for Laban. And about after a month of working, Laban said to Jacob, you can't keep working for no wages. Tell me what you want in wages and I'll pay them. And it's surprising to me that it was Jacob's idea that he work for 7 years. And as his wages, he wanted Rachel to be his wife. Now that seems like a long time to work for a wife, doesn't it? But it was Jacob's idea. We were told that to Jacob, the 7 years seemed but a few days. Brethren, that's a lesson in perspective, isn't it? How many men would work 7 years for their wives? But obviously, Jacob cherished the desire of having Rachel as his wife, so much so that that 7 years passed by like nothing. Brother Russell has a nice thought when he analyzes his story. He says, our love to God and to each other should be such as to cause our life's service to him and to the members of the body of Christ to seem to us even shorter comparatively than was Jacob's service for Rachel. If we were nearer perfect in love, a life of service to God in whatever way he might see fit to use us would be to us a pleasant service. Brethren, is that how you and I see our service to God or to the brethren? Or are there times that we grudge it or refuse to give it for one reason or another? That's happened in my life, in all honesty. There have been times of service that I grudge when I give it, and sometimes I don't give it for one reason or another. But if that's ever the case for any of us, even in isolated circumstances, then think about Jacob's love for Rachel for a moment. And think about how he served joyfully for 7 years with just the prospect of having Rachel as his wife. That spirit of Jacob's enthusiasm is the same attitude that we should always have when we serve the Lord and the brethren. You do it for the love that's in your heart, and you don't concern yourself with the cost. Well, you know the story as it continued to unfold. After 7 years of service, Jacob comes to Laban, and he asks that he fulfill his obligation and give Rachel to be his wife. And Laban prepares a great feast. And at the end of the feast, he takes Leah, and not Rachel, and gives her to Jacob. And it wasn't until the next morning after sleeping with Leah that Jacob discovered what Laban had done. And of course, as any of us would be, Jacob was shocked. And he went to Laban quite irritated with the whole thing. In Genesis 29:25, he says to Laban, "What is this thou hast done unto me? Did not I serve with thee for Rachel? Wherefore then hast thou beguiled me?" Does that word beguile remind you of something we discussed earlier? Here was Jacob, the beguiler of Isaac, being himself beguiled. I wonder if Jacob ever realized the irony of what happened to him. Just as Isaac could not see who was really standing before him when giving the blessing to Jacob, so Jacob didn't see that it was the wrong wife. It was someone else. Another irony was in the words that Laban used to explain why he did that. In the next verse, Genesis 29:26, Laban says, "It must not be so done in our country to give the younger before the firstborn." Here was another firstborn issue, but here it was used against Jacob. He had to marry the firstborn before he could have Rachel. I suspect that at this point in Jacob's life, this whole issue of the firstborn was kind of getting old for him. It really had brought him nothing but heartache. And so another deal was struck. And Jacob again agreed to serve 7 more years for Rachel. Was Rachel worth 14 years of service? Jacob thought so, because there was never a hesitation in his response to serve longer. You know, brother, when you think of it, that just reinforces the spiritual lesson that Brother Russell made. When we serve the Lord and the brethren, we should not hesitate to go the extra mile. That we shouldn't always just give the minimum that's required of us. We should give more deeply of ourselves. Be willing to serve longer, work harder for the Lord and the brethren, just as Jacob was willing to serve for 14 years for Rachel. You can sense that Jacob would have done anything because he was so in love with Rachel. In Genesis 29:27, Laban and Jacob are discussing the matter, and Laban says, "Fulfill her week, and we will give thee this also for the service which thou shalt serve with me." Well, apparently that marriage festival that they were presently observing during this discussion was a 7-day feast. So what Laban was really saying was, if you complete this week of festival without making any complaint and making a public spectacle, then I'll give you Rachel as well. Then after giving him Rachel, he would give him Rachel after that week was over, and then he would serve the additional 7 years. So he really had Rachel after 7 years and 1 week, and then he added the 7 years of service onto that. And I guess that made it a little easier to take than having to wait the whole 14 years for Rachel. But you know, Laban cheated Jacob. He frauded him here. And again, the lesson is clear. What you sow is what you'll reap. Jacob sowed deceit with Isaac, and here he was reaping deceit with Laban. You know, in this story, brethren, one person we don't usually talk about is Leah. How do you think that Leah felt about this whole experience? How would you feel if you were Leah and knew that Jacob didn't love you like he loved your younger sister, that he really didn't want you as a wife and he would never have served all those years for you? How would you have felt if your father had to deceive a man in order to get him to marry you? And then, what atmosphere could possibly fill your home after your sister came to live with you, after she became a wife to the man that you had just married. Things were not easy for Leah, and as we'll see, she did not make them easy for herself either. The Lord recognized her problem. In Genesis 29:31, he says, Jehovah saw that Leah was hated, or the thought is loved less, and he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. It seems that the Lord was trying to balance that relationship a little by allowing Leah to have children and not Rachel for a time. In fact, Leah went on to have 7 children until finally Rachel gave birth to her firstborn, Joseph. Jacob also had 4 children by Leah and Rachel's handmaidens. So before Rachel even bore one child, there were already 11 children born to Jacob. In spite of having 7 children by Jacob, the situation for Leah was always uncomfortable. She was jealous, and she had a sense of rivalry for all the years that Rachel was in the household. Isn't it sad that she would feel so insecure in her own family environment? You can see the competition that Leah felt by the very names that she chose for her children. If you look at your handout, you'll see a chart showing Jacob's children and the order that they were born in and which women bore which children and the names that were given to them. Leah's firstborn was named Reuben, and the name means see a son. Now that sounds innocent enough, but to watch the scene develop, we see that Leah was trying to establish herself as the prominent wife, the successful childbearer, the one responsible for the continuation of the name of Jacob. The name Reuben was a claim that she was making on her right to be Jacob's wife. Leah wanted to be remembered that her firstborn child was a son, almost as if stating, I'm really the better wife. Look at the son I have born. Leah then bore Simeon, which means hearing. In Genesis 29:33, she explains why she chose this name. She says, because the Lord has heard that I was hated. Again, we see it connected to her family struggle for Jacob's affection. Then comes Levi, which means joined. In verse 34, she says, because now my husband will be joined with me. And then Leah bears Judah, which means praise. And she states her reason in Genesis 29:35 that now I will praise the Lord. Now, if I'm catching the spirit that existed in Leah, the reason she praises the Lord with the birth of Judah is because now with one more son, she thought she would surely win Jacob's affection. Well, at this point, while Leah was making all these boastful claims and having all these sons to Jacob, we read that Rachel just couldn't stand it anymore. In Genesis 30, verse 1, she says, when Rachel saw that she bare Jacob no children, Rachel envied her sister and said unto Jacob, give me children or else I die. She was so frustrated that she finally told Jacob to take her handmaiden, Bilhah, and have children by her. And Bilhah then had Dan and Naphtali. The name Dan means judging. And Rachel explains in Genesis 36 that now God has judged me and heard my voice. And she tried to consider Dan as if he were her own son, and that now she was no longer barren through her handmaiden. At the birth of Naphtali, Rachel says in Genesis 30, verse 8, with great wrestlings have I wrestled with my sister, and I have prevailed. And she called his name Naphtali. Naphtali means wrestling. Well, Rachel now thought that she had prevailed over Leah because her handmaiden had now borne Jacob 2 sons. Well, isn't it clear that wrestling is a real part of this family? Not to be outdone by Rachel, Leah then gives her handmaiden to Jacob because she thought she was now no longer able to bear her own children. From her handmaiden Zilpah, Gad and Asher were born. Gad means a troop. It's almost a rebuttal to Rachel's claim to have that now she has brought forth a troop of sons. The name Asher means happy. And in verse 13 she says, happy am I, for the daughters will call me blessed. And again, blessed because she brought forth so many sons, blessed above Rachel. Well, we're going to have to skip the rest of those names, but they really tell the same story of competition between Leah and Rachel. Finally, in Genesis 30, verse 24, Rachel bears her son, and she calls him Joseph. She says that now with his birth, God has finally taken away her reproach. The name Joseph means adding. And the reason she chose it was because she felt now that her barren days were over, God would add unto her sons and God did, one more son. A few years later, after Jacob had returned to Canaan with his family, in a very difficult labor, Rachel bore her second son, whom she named Benoni, which means son of my affliction, to describe the childbirth difficult labor that she had. Rachel died, giving birth to Benoni, and shortly after that, Jacob changed the child's name to Benjamin, which means son of my right hand. What he meant was, now this was a son that was especially dear to him, because in the birth of Benjamin, Jacob had the last connection to his beloved Rachel. So, brethren, when you look at this household, it's a marvel at what happened between them. The roots of the nation of Israel came from Leah's desire to win Jacob's affection and acceptance, and Rachel's desire to bring forth sons to be equal to her older sister. The difficulties that they created amongst themselves are quite remarkable. As you look at the story, I don't know how you felt, but from a strictly human standpoint, I would not have wanted to live in that environment where there's such competition and jealousy. Certainly when the mothers were so much at odds, the children certainly could not fail to pick up that spirit themselves. And if you recall, that's what we see in the life of Joseph. Remember the story of how his older brothers resented his dreams that he would someday, that they would someday bow down to him. And a result of that jealousy, they wanted to kill him, but they eventually compromised and sold him into slavery. A well-balanced home environment is so important. Our homes should be a place that are completely devoid of jealousy, resentment, or competition in any way. Brethren, we have enough enemies outside that door. We don't need them in our homes. If there is ever anything in any of our homes that comes close to anything like this, we should work on that. Any division between us and our spouse or our children or our relatives, we should not accept that as a normal way of life. You know, Leah and Rachel could have risen above all of that, but they would have needed the Lord's help. They would have needed Jacob's help, and they certainly would have needed a deeper love for one another. You've heard the phrase that happiness is a choice, and in large measure, I think that's true. We can make a choice of being content with our lot in life. We can make a choice of encouraging love and good feelings. But in a family, it's a little different. Happiness and peace only work if that choice is made by each family member. Rachel could not have healed the family rift without Leah being part of the solution. Brethren, in that story, I can't help think of how the Lord can work his plan through people who have problems who are not always so good or so perfect. God had a predetermined plan to establish Israel as a nation. In spite of the battles between Leah and Rachel and their 13 children and the things that Jacob did, God accomplished that purpose. But again, that does not mean that there were not consequences to this family of Jacob. Whenever there is evil, whenever there is wrongdoing, or even a bad spirit, there are negative consequences, even if the Lord is still dealing with us along other lines. Jacob was greatly blessed by the Lord, but it took years for that to become clear. He had left Canaan all alone, with nothing to his name. But he returned to Canaan 20 years later, a wealthy man with a large family. The Lord blessed him for his father's sake and for the good that was in his own heart. But again, Jacob paid a price for what he did. His home life was not peaceful. His family was not united in the strong bonds of love that could have been there. In Genesis 30:25, Jacob had finished his 14 years of service, and he comes to Laban, and he wants to take his family back to Canaan. But Laban knew that if Jacob left, it would not be good for him. In verses 27 and 28, Laban says, "I pray thee, if now I have found favor in thine eyes, tarry. For I have learned by experience that the Lord hath blessed me for thy sake." And he said, "Appoint me thy wages, and I will give it." Well, Jacob had prospered while a servant of Laban, and now Laban convinced him to stay, and he ended up staying for six more years. That's where we get our 20, the seven, and the six. Laban, who always seemed to be trying to take advantage of Jacob, in the end was finally taken advantage of himself, because Jacob's flocks prospered, because he was living apart from Laban now, And Laban's flocks, because they didn't have the influence of Jacob, grew weaker. In Genesis 31, 1 through 3, it says that Jacob heard the words of Laban's sons, saying, Jacob hath taken away all that was our father's, and of that which was our father's hath he gotten all this glory. And Jacob beheld the countenance of Laban, and behold, it was not towards him as before. And Jehovah said unto Jacob, Return into the land of thy fathers, and to thy kindred, and I will be with thee. Finally, after 20 years of living in a foreign land, Jacob was ready to return to Canaan and confront his brother. Brethren, it was a long time to run away from his problems. But the time was not wasted, as we see. The Lord had been working with him and was gradually teaching him to be more dependent on God rather than on his own wit and cunning. You know, brethren, this really shows us how the Lord can use our mistakes and still work through them and help us grow. How long that growth takes usually depends on us. Sometimes it may take 20 years or more to learn how to be heart-reliant on the Lord. On his journey to Canaan, Jacob sent word ahead to Esau that he was returning, and word came back that Esau was coming out to meet him with 400 men. It's not exactly clear why Esau was bringing so many men with him, but because there were so many, it seemed to imply that Esau was still angry at Jacob and still may have wanted to kill him. When Jacob was told about Esau's band, he was terrified. In Genesis 32:9, we're told that he falls on his knees in prayer. Just that one thought, brethren, shows a major turning point for Jacob in his spiritual life. He goes to the Lord first. He's now learning how to deal with his problems by following a spiritual priority and seeking God's input first before things become completely with no solution to the human mind. We're told that Jacob was determined that he was not going to fight against his brother. And the next morning he sends gifts to Esau. He sent over 500 various types of animals from his flock to appease Esau's anger. Later that night he took his family and passed over the brook Jabbok, which is a river that flows into the Jordan about halfway between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea. That was Jacob's official re-entering into Canaan. And at Jabbok, he sends the others ahead, but he remains behind one last experience. And this is where we come to the famous story of Jacob wrestling with the angel. I'm not sure why Jacob decided to stay behind for that one last night, but it was the opportunity now for the angel to enter his experience. Let's read that account. This begins at Genesis 32, verse 24. It says, And Jacob was left alone, and there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day. And when he saw that he prevailed not against him, he touched the hollow of his thigh. And the hollow of Jacob's thigh was strained as he wrestled with him. And he said, Let me go, for the day breaketh. And he said, I will not let thee go, except thou bless me. This is truly an unusual story. Now the battle, I was trying to think of an analogy that might describe the difference of power between the angel and Jacob, and the only analogy I could come up with was an ant trying to wrestle an elephant. And the elephant holding back, and the ant thinks he's doing pretty good. But the observer knows it's only because the elephant is holding back that the ant isn't destroyed. Why did the Lord do this? Had he not promised to Jacob on a number of occasions that he would bless him? Had he not promised that he would be with him wherever he went? Why did God send an angel to wrestle Jacob? Well, there have been a number of suggestions about what actually went on here. There's not really much information in the account, like what did the angel look like? Did Jacob think that this was just a man trying to block his path? Why did they wrestle to begin with? Well, let me just quote a short paragraph from a treatment on this subject by Brother Donald Holliday. And his reasoning appeals to me. He says, Jacob begins the struggle believing he is wrestling with a human foe who attacks him. He schemes with man's thoughts in endeavor to outdo his human opponent, but sooner or later in the struggle he recognizes in himself the chief opponent, for he comes to realize that he is fighting with God. Well, in the story we're told that they wrestled all night, and in the morning the angel touched the hollow of his thigh and put it out of joint. It was sometime during the night while they were wrestling that Jacob came to the realization this is not just a man. Somehow he came to realize that this was an angel. Now, to me, the injury to Jacob sounds like the angel may have disjointed Jacob's hip. I don't know too much about that type of injury. Those brethren who have had hip replacements or hip problems know that that's an excruciating injury. But in spite of the potential pain that Jacob was in, he would not let go of the angel, but he insisted on receiving his blessings. And the angel then relents and blesses Jacob. And this is what the angel says in verse 27. He says, "What is thy name?" And he said, "Jacob." And he said, "Thy name shall no more be called Jacob, but Israel. For thou hast striven with God and with men and hast prevailed." Brethren, did the angel know Jacob's name? Of course he did. Why did he ask? Well, the angel, I believe, was trying to make a point. He wanted Jacob to realize that he was no longer to be like his first name, Jacob, the supplanter, the cunning, the crafty one who used his own devious ways to achieve his desires. From now on, he would be called Israel. And Israel means God prevails. From now on, Jacob would recognize that the only way to defeat any enemy he would ever encounter would be to submit himself to God and let God prevail in the battle. He was no longer to be a wrestler of men. We see God prevail later in Jacob's life in the story of Joseph. Now, brethren, had not God overruled behind the scenes and miraculously brought Joseph to power in Egypt, Jacob and his entire family may have died in that great famine. There was nothing that cunning or deception could have done to avoid the famine. But in the Lord's strength, in the Lord fighting and wrestling the battles for Jacob, an unbelievable miracle was performed in Egypt through the son of Rachel, and out of it, the nation of Israel was born. Brethren, there is a universal lesson being taught here, and it belongs not only to Jacob, not only to us, the church, but to the world of mankind, and it's the lesson of the permission of evil. Through our first parents in the Garden of Eden, mankind thought they knew a better way. They were willing to listen to an outside influence and not trust in the Lord's wisdom and guidance. They wrestled with the notion of becoming great without the Lord's help. And like Jacob, that wrestling match that mankind has experienced has been a painful one. It's been full of exile and servitude to sin. But like Jacob again, when the world humbles itself and seeks the Lord and learns how to struggle with the Lord on their side, to learn to struggle in all the right ways for God's blessings, then he will bless them and make them great. This disjointing of Jacob's hip, tradition says, was harmful to him and hurt maybe the tendons in the area. And it's believed that Jacob walked with a limp for the rest of his life. Brethren, that limp was a blessed reminder of that great truth, that Jacob could never walk alone without God's help. He needed the Lord to prevail. And I don't think Jacob ever forgot that lesson for the rest of his life. There's also a personal application to the scene of Jacob wrestling with the angel. Each of us has received wonderful promises from God. He's promised never to leave us. He's promised never to allow any trial that's more difficult than we can bear. He's promised to bless us and to use us in his work. But have you ever felt that there are times when those things just don't seem to be happening in your life? What the Lord appreciated in Jacob was that he persevered in his blessings from the Lord. This is what Brother Russell says about Jacob on reprint 3970. And this is really one of those gem thoughts from Brother Russell. He says, "We are to understand that it was God's good pleasure to give the blessing. He had already intimated this. But that the blessing might be valuable to Jacob, it was withheld for a time until he would more and more feel his need of it and cry out and struggle to obtain it, that when obtained, it might be the more highly esteemed and affect thereby the greater influence upon his heart and faith and future course. And so it is with our prayers." Sometimes, brethren, the Lord is trying to give us a deeper appreciation for the value and beauty of his blessings in our lives. We can easily take his favor for granted. When life is one struggle after another, and the Lord's blessings seem to delay, the lesson is persevere after God's blessings, and they will come. What happens in the next chapter of Jacob's life is truly touching. After this memorable night of wrestling with God's angel, we see Esau and his 400 men approaching Jacob and his family. As Jacob approached Esau, Jacob bowed himself to the ground 7 times before his older brother. In Genesis 33, verse 4, we read, "And Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept." Well, it seems to have been Jacob's humbling of himself before his brother that touched Esau so much. The humility of Jacob created compassion in Esau's heart, and the twin brothers finally came together and blessed one another, and at that moment, they were finally one, probably for the first time in their lives. Esau wondered what was meant by all the animals that Jacob had sent, and when Jacob explained that it had been to find favor in Esau's eyes, Esau replies in verse 9, "I have enough, my brother, let that which thou hast be thine." But Jacob insisted, and he says, "Take my blessing, because God has dealt graciously with me." That's such a beautiful spirit on both of their parts. It's so different than the selfish spirit we saw the last time that they were together. Jacob was now home, and he had made peace with his brother, but we find that the battles were not over in his life. He goes on and deals with many of the sins of his children. In the 34th chapter, he has to deal with the sins of Simeon and Levi when they murdered all the men of Shechem after their sister had been defiled by one of them. In the 35th chapter, the Lord instructs Jacob to return to Bethel, where he had seen that vision of the stairway to heaven, and there to build an altar. We're told that the purpose of returning to Bethel was to purify his family and have them put away the idols that they had. But as they journeyed to Bethel, they were in danger because of what Simeon and Levi had done. But in Genesis 35:5, we're told that as they journeyed to Bethel, they were protected from the people of the land because in some way the Lord had put a fear in the hearts of the people. And then God reiterates Jacob's name change, and he repeats the Abrahamic promise. After setting up an altar, Jacob and his family leave Bethel, and on the way home, Rachel delivers Benjamin, and she dies in childbirth. And that's where we'll end the story of Jacob. But again, brethren, I am so impressed at how the Lord took a man like Jacob and made a great nation out of him. In spite of his mistakes and shortcomings, the Lord developed his character, led him along the way from his natural propensity to wrestle himself to the top. Jacob learned how to let the Lord prevail in his life. That was his legacy, not just the sins, but the victory as well. That's his example. And brethren, it can be our example as well. It's always interesting to look at some of the possible prophetic applications to such detailed stories as this. And the application we usually make when we discuss Jacob and Esau is that Jacob represents a true church, and Esau represents the false church who, like Esau, sold their birthright. This picture is expressed a number of times in scriptures, and it's a good picture. But there's another one I'd like to examine just for a moment. It's a picture that you can read about on your new Bible Students Library CD, for those of you who have a computer. It's an article by the brother I quoted earlier, Brother Donald Holliday, and it's entitled Jacob and Jabbok. Now, I've tried to illustrate that on your handout, the application he's making. I've added some details to fill it in. And again, brethren, take this for what it's worth. I found it very interesting. He says that taken together, if you look at the lives of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, we have an illustration of various features of God's plan. Their names are listed across the bottom of the chart to show the general areas that they might represent. And it's really a picture of deliverance. It begins with Abraham receiving a very vague promise that God would bless his seed and make him a great nation while he was still in Babylon. And that small beginning might illustrate the vague hope of deliverance given to Adam. The 2 ages before Jesus are pictured by Abraham's walk of faith before the birth of Isaac. The first dispensation corresponds to Abraham's call to leave Babylon until Terah's death, when he took his first direct steps towards the promised land. As you see on the chart, the first 2 ages were a time of looking forward by faith to the coming of the promised seed. In the first dispensation, the promises of deliverance from the Adamic curse and the hope of future blessings were vague and relatively unclear. Like I said, that corresponds to the earlier life of Abraham before he actually left Babylon. The Lord had appeared to him, you remember, and promised that if he obeyed and went to Canaan, that God would make a great nation out of him. After the death of his father, Terah, Abraham came to Canaan, and the promise was officially given that God would bless him, and that through his seed all the families of the earth would be blessed. Dwelling in Canaan seems to picture the Jewish age, when the seed of Abraham became distinct and separated. It was also a time when the promises of future blessings became more clear, with more definitive hopes regarding Messiah. We see this in the fact that the law was clearly explained, that the law clearly explained the work of the Messiah more than it had ever done before. All the types and shadows of the law were given primarily to illustrate the coming Messiah and his work of redemption and blessing. When in the land of promise, we know that Abraham did not claim the land for himself. So the promises to Israel could not yet be fulfilled. It could not be claimed because Messiah had not come yet. Finally, after years of waiting for the birth of Isaac, Isaac was born, symbolic of the birth of the true Messiah. The offering of Isaac then pictures the actual death of Jesus. And when God provided a ram to take the place of Isaac, we see an illustration of the resurrection of Jesus. Remember, a ram was used in the tabernacle to show the acceptance of a previous sacrifice. So Jesus' resurrection was proof that his previous life of sacrifice had been acceptable to God. And this brings us to the end of the Jewish age, when the symbolic sacrifices of the law were no longer appropriate, and now a new and living way was opened up, and the call for a bride had begun. This was illustrated when Eliezer was sent to search out a bride for Isaac. And here we see an overlapping of our pictures a little bit, because besides searching for a spiritual bride, it was also a time of forced servitude for natural Israel in their double of disfavor. And that, we believe, is illustrated by Jacob's exile from Canaan and his 20 years of servitude to Laban. As Esau remained in Canaan, so for much of the time, the Arabs occupied the land of Israel, as Israel was dispersed throughout the world. As God gave Jacob a vision of the stairway to heaven as an encouragement to his faith, so Israel, even in their disbursement, had the promise that through them all the families of the earth would be blessed. In that vision of Jacob's ladder was also the promise that someday God would bring them back to their homeland. That corresponds to the Lord's promises that he would regather Israel from the four corners of the earth, from whithersoever he hath driven them. To Jews everywhere, the promise of returning to their land was a powerful message, and it was a message that helped sustain them through their ordeal and persecution of the diaspora. Remember, their rallying cry was next year in Jerusalem. In spite of Jacob's servitude to Laban, we see that he prospered, even to the point where Laban's sons hated him and accused him of taking away everything that belonged to their father. Well, Jacob had used his intelligence and cunning to gain wealth for himself. But even in this, Laban prospered because of Jacob. Well, these accusations might well illustrate the Gentiles' propensity to blame the Jews for everything. And we see that happen all down through the age, but we especially see it magnified in Nazism, when Jews were blamed for all the problems of Germany, the economic problems, the social problems. Every ill of society was blamed on the Jews. In the story of Jacob, Laban and the others were not permitted to hurt Jacob or his family. And so we believe the present-day enemies of Israel will not be permitted by God to hurt Israel in any way. Shortly before Jacob returned to Canaan, his first son through Rachel was born. The birth of Joseph was a much more precious thing to Jacob than the birth of his other sons, and the reason was that Rachel was more favored by him, just as a grace covenant is more favored than the law covenant. In this picture, the birth of Joseph, we think, might correspond to the Lord's return in 1874. And in Joseph's life, we see a beautiful picture of the work of the kingdom. Joseph's future mission, after being raised to great power in Egypt, would be to deliver his brethren from the famine in the land. It was a picture of the glorified Christ and the work of blessing and saving mankind from a spiritual famine and death. The scene of Jacob wrestling with the angel might correspond to natural Israel's restoration to the land. It was when Jacob wrestled with the angel that his name was changed to Israel, the first step in transforming a family into a nation. It was the night before Jacob crossed the river Jabbok that this occurred, and so the birth of Israel came after an intense struggle for the Lord's blessings, a struggle that we see continuing even today. There is still conflict between Arabs and Jews that has yet to be resolved. But just as the Lord softened Esau's heart, so we know he's going to soften the Arabs. There will be ongoing struggles and conflicts between Jews and Arabs, but brethren, the final reconciliation between them will not be a military one. The final peace will come through the generosity and the love of Israel and their leaders, the ancient worthies, and the resulting tender heart response by their Arab brothers. Someday, Jews and Arabs will fall on each other's necks and cry together as brothers. Brethren, we are out of time, so we won't cover the rest of the chart, but it's, I hope, self-explanatory. The last picture that we see in the sequence is when God commanded Jacob to take his family and go to Egypt for the famine so that they could be blessed by Joseph. Joseph was Jacob's natural son, and yet in his new role as the head of Egypt, he was now Jacob's Lord. It's a picture of a spiritual role reversal between the church and the ancient worthies. Psalms 45:16, it says, "Instead of thy father shall be thy children, whom thou mayst make princes in all the earth."
I'd like to thank Brother Tom for his thoughts on the story of Jacob. And what a wonderful thought it is that as we walk with the Lord and we allow the Lord to do the leading, how much better our character is shapen. And we can certainly see that in the story of Jacob. I have a few announcements before we close. And 17, hymn 117. We'll have better time close with a prayer, and we'll sing all three verses and rise on the last.
Gracious Heavenly Father, we thank you for the privilege of meeting together. We thank you for the precious lessons in thy word. We thank you for the honesty and openness that you have recorded them. Help us, Father, to realize that even in our sins and shortcomings, that we can be overcomers by thy grace and strength. We thank you for the gift of thy precious Son. Pray for more of thy Spirit to be with us. Help it to indwell in us more and more and to be conformed to the image of thy Son. We ask a blessing on our continued fellowship and study together, and we commit this convention into thy loving care and keeping. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.